Okay.
You act a little nervous. Like
Tracy, quit talking. While we were talking about the women deal, if you didn't get to come and you would have liked to heard what it was called, the Awakening Conference, and there's audio. These are the last two that are out there. If you want more, let Jeremy know. But if you want to take these with you, I'll just set them on the table here. You take both of them? Okay, well, whatever you want. Take one, and if somebody else wants one, why, please feel free to take it, and we don't copyright or do any of those kinds of things. We have permission. Is that right, Jeremy? Good. I thought we did. But anyway. So I hope you all got my email, and obviously you're here, so you must have got part of them. I want to talk today, and I want to kind of take you down the road. We put a couple of chairs together over here for you guys, Terry and Pat, right next to Randy. Anyway, let me try and kind of lay out for you where I want to go. And in all of my ministry experience, which is at two churches, and so it doesn't make me an expert, but I spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to do things that I call uncharted territory. And it really doesn't make any difference whether your church has tried something and failed and now you want to try it again, whether they tried something and they were successful, but they stopped doing it. Every time church leadership changes, there's going to be uncharted territory where you're taking the diverse group of people that God has given you and trying to lead them somewhere. And obviously this is about leadership. For, you know, that's what we do here at these meetings. And so we're going to tell some stories today. Obviously, I take some risk in telling these stories because they're about people that either go to this church. I mean, people who are oftentimes really difficult end up in your church. You all probably have some. And you probably have some who supported the last guy. And you probably have some that support you. And there's a tension there. There's always a tension there, and you've got some people who, because they've been in your church a long time, they're absolutely comfortable with stepping over the soft spot in the floor that you would fall through if everybody stood on it, you know, but they know it's there, so they just walk around it. You know, they're willing to wiggle the toilet handle or do whatever else takes place. They're willing to wait 4 hours for coffee to make because the coffee pot is 100 years old, but it works for them. There's all kinds of things like that where you end up just fighting these battles. And so that's really what we're going to talk about here. And so I want to tell you, at least initially here, one of my uncharted territory stories. When I first came to this church had a school, kindergarten through fifth grade. In the last year of its existence, we had about 45 commitments to come to school here, and about 5 to 10 were thinking about it. In April of the year previous to the close, I got together with our elders, and I had worked for about 18 months producing and revamping a student handbook and a teacher's handbook. Okay, so we had at least 6 teachers. Generally speaking, kindergarten through fifth grade, generally we had a principal, and so we had a lot of employees in here. It took a lot, and it was a dual-use building. It was our school, the church's school, and so and it was called a Christian school. In the midst of my time at the beginning, I asked the question, do we have a Christian school or do we have a school for Christians? By the way, that's important. If you have a school for Christians, then we were succeeding at that because everybody in our school at the point I was asking this question would have gotten their Christianity from home or from their own church experience. We had the best families and the best kids in the area, okay? And so I began to ask that question. Well, their vision was that this was a Christian school, which to me meant that instead of having Christians come to school, that we were bringing kids to school to make them into Christians. It was a school that taught Christianity. We had no unsaved kids. We had zero. And I went, okay, what's wrong with this picture if this is our vision? So we started going down that road. So then we opened our enrollment up to what we would call now questionable kids. And that's uncharted territory, right? Because you don't know what their parents... We had the best kids, the best parents. We had no problems whatsoever. Everybody was in agreement. It was the greatest thing. We brought in two or three extra kids who needed what we thought we had. And it upset the apple cart in a big time way. I mean, it was huge. And so we had to figure out whether our vision fit with what we were doing. And so we've been talking about that for a couple of years. And in that April when we got together and I said, listen, we need this documentation. We need these things. We need parents to sign on to this. We need teachers to sign on to this. We'd had some issues where one of the teachers who kind of had some Hebrew bent to her had built a mock-up model of the tabernacle using sheets stapled to the ceiling in her classroom, which just caused me to go, like this. So I was tilting a little bit. All those things, you know, you just got to figure out how do you handle those things. And obviously, if you have to talk about those things and somebody doesn't agree with what your solution is, the possibility for offense and difficulty is huge. And so anyway, we were talking about that. And one of the guys who had championed that school for 22 years at that point, he was a driving force behind the school. He pushed his material back and said, we need to pray. I think we're done. And at that meeting, we don't do anything in our church without everyone being on board. We won't move. We don't talk about it. We don't try and manipulate and twist in the wind. If you're not in agreement, we'll have another meeting later. We'll pray till everybody's in agreement. It was unanimous that night that we would close the school. Now, as a leader, it wasn't my job to say, you'll never guess who wants to close the school. It wasn't my idea. I was in agreement with it. Don't mishear this. I wasn't railroaded. I was in agreement. But as long as we're here and I'm leading, if this is what we're supposed to do, we're going to charge with all we have, all we're worth, we're going to charge towards this. But now we're closing the school. And so for the next block of time, I had to lead this church in uncharted territory. This church started and essentially started a Christian school almost the same time. That was their heritage. That was their tradition. They'd had it. Now, you may not have a Christian school, but I'll guarantee you, your church has some level of heritage and or tradition. And I will also guarantee you, if you're not fighting against some of that, you are dead from the neck up. Okay? What worked yesterday may not work today. Right? I mean, this is a fairly traditional church, and at least half of our church is technologically astute, and about half of it is still using a wind generator to produce electricity or something. I mean, it's just this dichotomy of stuff here. You got to navigate all that stuff. It's all uncharted territory. So when the 70-year-old woman calls up and says, why don't we have a prayer chain anymore? What I want to say is because all it was phone calls for rumors. That's what I want to say. But we have a different way of communicating today. It's changed. It's changed. And yes, if you haven't had any of those arguments, you know, welcome to the world of growing inside your own personal ministry and inside your church. So every time there's a leadership change, you get uncharted territory. Even though you know where you're going, they're looking at you funny. They are flat looking at you funny. And like I said, I had to lead this church, and for 18 months, I got shot at a lot. Because I was the new pastor who closed the school. It takes a little bit of stamina, just a little, to put up with that. Because what I wanted to say was, you don't understand. I was doing everything in my power to make this school successful. Now, again, I want to keep emphasizing, in particular in case any of my own people listen to this, I was in agreement with closing the school. I voted yes, and I could have held that up. In our board situation, the pastor is an elder. So my elders submit to me pastorally. I submit to them in an elder fashion. So I'm an elder on the same level with them. My vote counts. And I can hold things up as well as any of them can hold things up. We do nothing other than through unanimity. So if everybody doesn't raise their hand, shake their head or whatever. But once you do that, I want to tell you, you are set in stone. Don't you dare back away from what you said in private as a leader just because somebody shoots at us. And I've been here 14 years. We've had that twice. That is not the right thing to do with me. If you say one thing to me face to face and then somebody pushes a little pressure on you and you waffle, you and me are going to have a come to Jesus movement. It's going to happen because leadership is that important. You've got to be willing. So even though we've never been there before, somebody has to lead. So that's really what we want to talk about today is uncharted territory. So hopefully in the morning session, we're going to talk about the navigation principles. We're going to talk about finding leaders in there. We're going to talk about redefining reality. You understand that your dream isn't yet reality, even though you're living it as if it's happening. But your dream is not reality. If you have any vision at all, you talk as if your vision has come to pass. Right? Here's where we are. Here's where we're going. Praise God. You can't believe what I can see that's happening 5 years from now. You know, when we started some of the ministries we're doing now, I could see those things. Tracy could see those things coming. And so, anyway, I don't know. I want to give an introduction. Is that where your stuff fits there? You want to just jump in?
You want me to share what?
I want you to do whatever you want to do, you know.
Well, as we were praying about it, I think the part that God was showing me is that it seems like that when, as pastors, you're the one that God gives the vision to. And you have this vision, and all of a sudden the people are like, wait a minute, this is completely different. And people don't like change. And so normally a vision has change in it. And, you know, so right away it seems like that you meet that resistance. And, you know, and then you have people that are more vocal than others. And I found myself wanting to stay away from the vocal people because it just seemed like, you just knew if God gave you a vision and there was going to be some change, you could just pretty much name the ones that were going to stand up and rebel against it and give you it, you know, struggles with it. Well, through the years, God's really been showing me that I didn't deal with those people properly at times, that because I would get offended a little bit, you know, and get frustrated with them, that I would kind of just back away, and if I saw them coming, I might try to go through one door to not have to just get caught by them to listen to why they had issues with what we felt like God had said to do. And what God has shown me through the years is he's told me, he said, you know what, I have called you, yes, to lead the people and to give them the vision, but I've also called you to be Jesus to them. And so he said, your attitude needs to be Christ-like. And, you know, and so, you know, for one of the things, the scriptures that God gave me was to know no man according to the flesh. This is what Paul, you know, had said that was his purpose. And God said to me, he said, when you continually look at that person and know that they're going to have issues and you have yourself guarded, you know them according to the flesh. And you've already prepared in your heart to respond to them according to the flesh. Well, our battle is not with flesh and blood, and our battle, you know, is not won with flesh and blood. So then I said, okay, Lord, then show me here, and you're going to have to help me, because obviously I don't like dealing with people like that. And so he said to me, he said, okay, he said, I want you to ask me on how to pray for them, how you can minister Jesus to them, and I want you to ask me to see them according to the way I see them instead of the way that you see them in the natural and in the flesh, which is a troublemaker, you know. And it's just interesting. I would just, because we would know that in our board meetings that there had to be total unity, if you just have somebody that kind of struggles with change and, you know, and they're just always there, then I was always braced. And I had kind of prepared myself in the flesh to respond in the flesh. And so learning how to respond in the spirit and learning how to, you know, to surrender to God and say, okay, Lord, start with me. And it was a lot different than the way I was doing it in my own strength. And when I started learning how to do that, then I felt free. I had peace. God starts showing me that, yes, he gives us the vision, but then it's his responsibility to see to it that it comes to pass. And, you know, sometimes we get the vision, and then I try to add my own wisdom and try to figure out how to accomplish that. And, you know, now I think I'm learning more and more that, okay, God, you've given me the vision. Yes, we will put it out there, and, you know, and you'll give us wisdom to step, you know, step by step. But I'm going to trust you that in your perfect timing, it'll come to pass, because we know that, that God is an infinite God, that he doesn't have boundaries, limits, and there's no time in God. You know, we're the finite people that have time. And, you know, most of the time, if I was to be real honest, when God gives us a vision, it never happens as quickly as what I think it should happen. Or that, you know, I mean, you know, we're trying to slow down and say, okay, Lord. And I think that, that God does that to protect us, you know, giving us leaders around us that, that say, hey, what about this? Or, you know, or just to slow it down a little bit. Because, you know, God can change. The scriptures tell us that he can change the king's heart and direct it, you know, wherever he chooses. And so, you know what? Instead of looking at people, difficult people, as a stumbling block to stop me from being able to go forth and do what God wants me to do or wants us to do as a body, I don't see them that way anymore, because it's like, no, God, you can turn their hearts at the right time that you choose to turn them. What you want for me is you want me, you know, to love them and to show them Jesus instead of withdrawing and trying to hide from them, and just keep lovingly and gently giving out what God says, you know. And what it did for me is it's given me a peace, and it's been, I'm able to slow down a little bit and say, okay, you know, this is the direction. Before, I'd have to be honest and say at times I would take it personally. You know, it was like, y'all, you know, we spend this time with God. Do you not trust us? Do you not, you know? And God keeps, he would always say to me, it's not about you. And I'm like, okay, it's not about me. But, you know, so for me, when it comes to uncharted territory, that would be the area, if I was to be real transparent, that I struggled with personally more than anything. And some of it, God's had to deal with me about being a man pleaser, because God said to me, you know, if it didn't bother you what people said, you know, then I wouldn't be a man pleaser. And I'm like, well, and sometimes I would even say it doesn't bother me, you know, and say, oh no, it doesn't bother me. But then God would get me in my prayer time, and he would say, well, but you know, what about the emotion? What was your reaction on the inside? And it's like, okay, Lord, I'm really sorry. I surrender. You know, I ask that you would heal my heart so that I can be whole, so that I can minister to, you know, to the body. Because I totally believe that when God has called us to do something, that he will see to it that his vision and his plan and purpose is fulfilled. It's just, for me, it's learning how to love the people, the difficult people, through it. You know, it's easy when you have somebody that's excited and right there and wants to go. But, and honestly, any time that we've had a change, I would say we've met with some resistance. Wouldn't you say that?
Yeah, there's all, you know, and it always feels personal. That's the other thing that I want you to realize, is that you're sitting next to people who have tried to do things, whatever God has said to them, and they fought the personal battle as well. It feels personal. You heard God's voice. You're going this direction, and all of a sudden, somebody who is likely good-hearted, but you may see them closer to the devil's plant than you do a good-hearted Christian, quite honestly, and it feels personal. Well, let's draw a couple scriptural conclusions here. And forgive me, I'm not trying to teach you anything. I just want to, I mean, not that kind of stuff scripturally, but I just want you to process that the Bible is full of uncharted territory for people. It starts at the beginning When Adam and Eve were kicked out of the garden, they walked into uncharted territory. They had to figure out. Things changed. When God told Noah to build the big boat, it took a day or two. And people came up to me, and I read between the lines, okay? But you really think that if he was building that thing, you know, he's 500 years old, he started having kids, his kids were adults and married when the boat was built and they got on there, so you do the math, that might have taken from 50 to 80 years, maybe even longer, to build the boat. You think it drew some notice? Suppose the neighborhood folks came out of the cul-de-sac to take a look at what he was building? You think any of them had anything to say? And do you think it felt personal? See, that's the thing. As spiritual people, sometimes we say, oh, well, that's what God has said. And you know, we even change our voice and put a U in his name and God, you know. And it's personal sometimes. It just feels personal. And it's hard. Let's just recognize that leading through transition is difficult. I remember when I first started processing this, I was reminded of when this man right back here is my oldest son. I remember when he was born. When Tracy began, she was in labor 47 hours doing nothing. I mean, she was doing something, but it wasn't working, okay? So the doctor came in and did the little thing that they do, and 1 hour and 8 minutes later, he was on the scene. During that 1 hour of transition, my wife was difficult. Difficult. She would have a pain, and she had her hand on my shoulder because we're in a bigger hospital. We were in the labor room that was the closest one to the delivery room. So for 2 days, they just rolled people past us, going in to have their baby. And we were working in the restaurant business, so I'd call people at our restaurant. Hey, could you bring me up some food? You know, I'll have a shrimp basket. Bring me up some, you know, bring me up a hamburger. And so one of our employees would show up with food, you know, and I was in there eating and all that kind of. But in 1 hour, she transitioned from a very hardly having any work to the necessary centimeter width to deliver a baby. In 1 hour, she went through transition really quickly, and it was painful for me. See, all the wisdom. Did you see how, you know, all the women who had enough guts for you, can you imagine what was happening to her? I don't care at that point because it's affecting me. Now, put that in your spiritual life, because when you're trying to vision out change and people resist the transition, you will say, what about me? When Abraham was told, hey, leave your family, leave this area, and this is my favorite one, because he said, go to the area that I'll show you. Oh, now that's comforting. Right? Because he doesn't really... Remember Joseph's story? 17-year-old kid tells his brothers, you know, family, you're going to bow down before me. And near as I can tell, it took a good portion of years for that to come to pass. A good portion of years for that to come. I mean, he was maybe 30 or 37 or something like that, and then they had 7 years. And so it might have taken 25 years for that to happen. And that's uncharted territory where you just don't know what it looks like. I love Daniel and his uncharted territory. Do you think that Daniel knew when he set up to pray openly with his, that they might throw him in the fire or in the lion's den or whatever else happened to him? You think that he says, well, all right, bless God. You know how some people get. Bless God, we're just going to do this anyway. You know, really? That was in your thought process, that they're going to put you in the lion's den and you got the possibility? And then you have the wherewithal to say, whether God delivers me, and as in the fire thing, whether God delivers me or not, I don't really care. I'm still going to. See, it's so personal that it's very difficult for us to have those opinions where you just say, well, bless God, whatever happens, you know, I'm in this, you're going to have to pry my dead cold fingers off my pulpit. You're never getting this back from me. You know, I mean, it feels so personal. And so we have to learn how to chart the uncharted. What does it look like? So if you want, you can look in the book of Exodus or the book of Numbers if you would like. But you don't have to. Numbers 13 is the story of sending out the spies. You all know that, and I'm not going to teach you anything that you haven't already thought up. But I want you to put your own process of uncharted territory in there. Maybe you're in the place where you're trying to lead your church to something that they may say, we've tried that before and failed. You may be trying to lead your church to something they've never experienced. You know, I've been in churches that have never had staff before. And I want to tell you, leading into the uncharted area of staff is difficult. Because people will say, it's personal, we're paying you to do that. They will look at you, you work 35 minutes a week, what is your issue? Why do you need more help? You know, what are they going to do? And for reasons that are just beyond me at times, I get a little wound up about things like this. So in my first church, we had an opportunity to hire a young man who needed some help and was a trained seminary graduate who had failed at everything he'd ever tried, and he was in our church. And so we were going to pay him $250 a week. This is in the 80s. We wanted to pay him $250 a week. We had 50 families in our church. So I don't know where your church is in relationship to that. We had 50 families. So I went to them saying, God, you got to give us, because we had no money, you know, I mean, not enough. And so I went to the church, and over the course of about 6 weeks, I said, you know, we can hire this guy if every one of you would give up your 7-Eleven money. 50 families, $5 a week. Now, that's navigating uncharted territory. Where are you going to come up with that money? You think it's just because God's called you to hire somebody, you think he's going to rain money down from heaven? You know, maybe not. You may have to come up with creative ways to do that. I remember in my last church, and we might even talk JR into talking about this a little bit. Before I left there, we were had grown to where the building was. We were just packed in there. One of my elders had died, and so we had a big funeral coming up. Well, we were also planning to build onto the church. And so we had laid cement and sidewalk and different things like that, and we'd staked out what the new part of the building looked like. And so this man was fairly known in the area. And so the sanctuary would seat between 150 packed in, maybe 160 packed in. And so we had it packed in. And we had between, you know, 250 and 400 people in our building. We had them everywhere. Do you know where they parked? Right on top of the stakes for the new building. Now do the math. If you're building a church that's going to seat 250 people, and they're parking where the building's going to be, what are you going to do when they need to park and the building is there? Because we were landlocked. That's some uncharted territory. He is now facing some of those same people that were there when I was there. He's facing that now, where we've tried that. It didn't work. And of course, it was his dad, which has got to be the worst possible circumstance. I just can't imagine what that uncharted territory is like. You know, in his case, his dad, who probably many of those people saw me as successful. Still do. Okay, good. Well, I'm pleased about that. But here's the uncharted territory. If I was successful and I couldn't do it, what makes the 12-year-old son who we knew, you know, now he's not 12 anymore, but what makes him think he can do it? Your dad, who was successful here, he's followed four pastors, and is it all right if... So he's followed four pastors. Every one of them took a whack at the church. There was hardly anything left when he got there. So everybody took it in the wrong direction. And now he's trying to take it into... I'm telling you, it's uncharted territory, and it's difficult because the glowing picture is his father. Right? I mean, I wouldn't want to do that. It's personal, isn't it? It's personal. You know, he doesn't want to live in the shadow of his dad. He doesn't want people to put what I couldn't do on him. It's uncharted territory. You don't want what the pastor who was before you to affect yours. So, what are we going to do? In every case of navigating uncharted territory, leaders are a part of the process. Now, you know the story. They sent out leaders. And in fact, I'll just read it to you in Numbers because it's real powerful. In my opinion, it's real powerful. Notice in chapter 13 in 2, it says, send men out to spy out the land of Canaan, which I'm giving to the children of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers, you'll send out a man, every one a leader among them. He said, send out some leaders. If you keep reading, it says that somewhere in there, it says they're all heads of three. So Moses sent them out from the wilderness of Paran, according to the commandment of the Lord, all of them men who were heads of the children of Israel, family heads. So if you want navigation principles, the first thing you have to do is to assess the leaders. Now, some of you have a process of establishing leaders in your church that is by election, and they come and go. That means that you may have someone on that leader, whether it's elders or deacons or whatever your group is called, that in 2 years or so, they're going to get voted off and we're going to have to start all over. So in some cases, the leaders that you need to assess may not be on your board. They may not be on your board. You may have to assess in your church who's leading, both visibly and behind the scenes. I would guess that most of you have an understanding there are some people behind the scenes in your church that are leading. They're the vocal minority that are speaking in the coffee shop and doing some of that kind of thing. You have to assess those things. Here's what leaders do for you. First of all, they help you go against the anthropological rule of 150. The guy that basically did all these studies. And basically, we are wired based on the size of our brain to be able to process, relationship-wise, about 150 people. Okay? So, if you're like the average church in America, and maybe you are, maybe you aren't. I'm not here to tell you that. But, you know, the average church has 138 members. So it just fits from an anthropological viewpoint. If you're ever going to get bigger than that, you're going to have to let some people lead some of the people. I mean, Moses had that, right? Point out some heads over these people and over this 50 and over this 100 and that kind of stuff. You're going to have to figure out how somebody else can pastor some of the people. You have to assess the leadership, okay? Leadership will help you navigate destination disease. We had a pastor that comes to these meetings. And the first year, he came to me, and he was so excited. He says, Glenn, we've worked so hard. And they paid their building off in December of that year. A young guy. And I looked at him, and I said, so, brother, what are you going to do now? See, they had destination disease. We're going to pay this building off. So if you're trying to get the staff member, build the building, make this change, do whatever else, make sure that the end isn't the end. When they paid off their building, they had nothing to focus on. He came back to me 3 or 4 months later. They'd lost membership and they'd lost focus because they had nothing to shoot at. Kind of, right? So leaders will help you do that. And then leaders will help you with the reality of your dream. Now, here's what I mean by the reality of your dream. I learned this from Terry, and I learned it from Alan Harris in Julesburg. Okay? These guys are in a very small drawing radius area. If everybody in your area came to your church might be 100 people. Okay? Alan Harris up in Julesburg has 1,000 people in whatever that county is up there. Okay? And 700 of them live in Julesburg. He has a church of 100. He is knocking it out of the park up there, okay? He's absolutely knocking it out of the park. So his dream reality should not include the idea that they're going to build a 1,000-member church. Where are you going to get the 1,000 people? How far are they going to drive? Right? It's just not, I don't know how many people are in your county, but if your church is going to be 500 people, they're going to be driving from Wyoming, right? And so dream reality is really important. How many people do you think really would come to your church? You know, when the people that were here before me built this church, there's absolutely no idea that they would utilize the space they built for. Well, since we've been here, we've had to remodel closets because we were out of space. But somebody needs to check the reality of your dream. Leaders will help you do that. Now, there's a difference between checking the reality of your dream and being a dream crusher. Okay? You need to run from dream crushers. if they feel like their whole job is to criticize and keep reality at forefront, you need to figure out how not to use them. There are some people whose job it is to keep you poor and to keep you unsuccessful. We can't do that here. Now, I don't know what you know about our church, and it doesn't make any difference to me, but if you just step back in at our church or any of y'all's churches and look at it, and you think, what were they thinking there? You know, I will tell you that our dream reality in this church has had nothing to do with what it looks like today. And by the way, whose brilliant idea was it to build this church in the middle of nowhere? I mean, whose idea was that? I can tell you whose idea it was. People gave us the land. By the way, if somebody gives you the land, see what you should build on it. You know, you can be lightning quick and catch up with that one. They gave us the land. Okay, let's dig a hole. And literally, guys, farmers with tractors came in and dug a hole. Let's start here, they said. It's just crazy. And some people said, that'll never work. Those people aren't in this church today. Because they're watching it work, but, you know, it won't work. How can you build a church debt-free? Well, that'll never work. Yes, it will. Hide and watch. It'll work. This church has never had an ounce of debt. I don't say that to say that's how you should do it. I say that to say that the dream that these guys had before I got here was to build a church debt-free. It took them a long time. But they built it debt-free. They refused to move based on debt. So if somebody's going to say, well, you just can't do that, just walk away, okay? Spiritual dreams have a psychological problem, okay? There's a term in psychology called cognitive dissonance. What it means is the existence of two competing and true thought processes. And so people will get caught there, okay? It's kind of like a psychological oxymoron, okay? And so they get caught there, you know? So logic tells us that you can't build a church for 300 people 2 miles from the nearest town of 130 people, right? I mean, there's more cows around here than there are people. You can't do that. And yet there's this cognitive dissonance that comes up psychologically when you have God's word on it, when he's spoken to you. So you have to fight that battle. So when you find leaders, they will help you redefine reality. They'll help you find what the dream should be. They'll help you with... How many of you know that leaders with a level of urgency in their spirit are worth their weight in gold? Where they're just going, bless God, I see it. They don't see anything. What they're saying is they get the kind of spiritual impact of it. So evaluate the leaders. Get to the place where you can say, okay, I need leadership help here. Because you see, leadership help will help you in the pathways. You understand that you can't hold everybody's hand, right? You simply can't hold everybody's hand. So you need leaders who will be willing to take a hold of what the church is doing. So here's how I do it. I break it into four groups of people. There are some people who will want to produce the same results through the same ways. In your church, they're teaching Sunday school, and they'll teach Sunday school until they die, and you'll be able to bury them with them. Little tacky little, you know, brown pieces of paper that the denomination sends out. Okay? They want to produce the same results through the same ways. Those people are valuable, and you've got to embrace them. So again, that's one group. Second group is the same results through new ways. Can you see that there's going to be a conflict between person A and person B? Right? Because the new way, we have some people in our Sunday school department who are always looking for the new way. You know, and they're occasionally pushing against the people who are doing it the old way. There's a tension there. Leaders help you in that. So in our case, in that particular discussion, I don't exactly know what's happening downstairs, but I know Tracy does. I know that tension exists between the, and it's not difficult, but Tracy has a staff member that helps with that, that modifies that, that works together with those people so they can all work together. The third group of people are new results through the same ways. People who have a vision that say, well, let's keep doing this, but look at the new results. Now, almost every pastor who comes will fit in this category, comes to a church, will fit in this category where they're getting new results through the same ways because they'll bring their kind of anointing into that. So we're doing the same kind of programming here, but in some of our programming, we're getting different results. We're getting different results. We're using new tools. We're doing, and the fourth group of people is new results through new ways. So you get new results through the same ways. So you thought you were teaching Sunday school, but what you were really doing is teaching leadership principles. That's the new thing, the new results that we got out of doing the same things. If you were to come here on a Sunday morning, you would see some of our kids operating in ministry and leadership because the new results through the same program has some fruit. So four groups of people, same results, the same ways. Look for leaders who can have that kind of vision, who can help you. Now, going back to Moses' story here, 10 of these guys decided that it wasn't a great idea to do what God said. Two of them decided it was a great idea, and Moses had to lead that group. Moses had to lead that group. Do you think Moses knew they should go and take the land? Because I think he did. But his overarching instruction was, lead my people into the promised land. Don't leave 10 out of 12 groups behind. So what did he have to do? See, if you look at Moses' dream reality, it took him 40 years, and it was painful for him. The people who resisted died in the wilderness. Some of the people who are resisting in your church, not necessarily physically, but they'll die. They'll leave. They'll leave. If you're going to change, they'll leave. Plain and simple. What do you suppose Moses thought about all that? What do you suppose Moses did when he was officiating over all the funerals? What's that? Praise the Lord. They're gone. Yeah, hallelujah. And when it's personal, I mean, you go, man, if that pain in the drain guy in my church ever leaves, we're going to have a hallelujah party at our house. I'm just telling you right now, it's going to happen. But on the other hand, Moses' heart, right, he wrote of himself, which I just find fascinating, that he was the most humble guy on the earth. I don't know how many of you find that amazing that he wrote about himself that he was humble. But anyway, I'm going to take that as eternally true because I believe the Bible is eternally true. So he was writing something that was correct, but it's still fascinating to me. So what do you suppose? See, that's when you start processing this. So when you start processing this, you go, wait a minute, what did that look like? And you can learn so many neat things from just reading the story and looking at it and going, well, what do you think he did here? So leaders help in assessing kind of ministry direction or ministry pathways. And there are four types of pathways. And your church has every one of them either in operation or in consideration. If you're saying, we want to do something new. Okay, well, that might be the new way. Okay, maybe new results. Maybe you're seeing, I know a pastor who has a bunch of kind of the grunge kids, the real musical grunge kids. What do you suppose he's doing? He got a new way and a new result. He's got all these freaked out, tattooed, ear-pierced, long-haired, green-eyed freakos who love Jesus. Well, in some of our churches, quite honestly, if they showed up, they'd get to sit in their chair and or pew and or row by themselves. They could cut a wide swath because they're not like us. So what do we do? As a leader, got to figure that out. We had a guy in our church several years ago who had a plan to get his arms and his whole upper body tattooed. So he had it all the way down to his sleeves like this. He was quite proud of it. But he had pictures of wolves and skulls and things like that, and he was called to children's ministry. Wear a long sleeve shirt till the kids get used to it, right? I mean, you understand what I'm saying, right? There's a guy in prison, in a prison ministry, he's scared of clowns. He's in prison. He's scared of clowns. He's a murderer, but he's scared of a lot of interesting little things there. Underneath his hairline, he's completely tattooed. So about once a year, he shaves his head completely off. And right in the center, on top of his head, is whatever. I don't remember what they called the phobia for clowns, but that's what it says because I asked him. He's one freaky looking dude. Loves Jesus. Now, if you're going to pastor people like that, you may want to consider the new ways that are necessary and the new results that might come from that. As a leader, you've got to lead in those times. I ask myself the question, what did Moses say to the 10 groups or 10 families that didn't want to go? What did he say to them? Because it looks like they won. See how I mean it's personal? Well, they didn't really win. They got to die. They didn't win at all. But it looked like they did. And of course, they wandered for 40 years on a 14-day walk. how do you process that? You look for those leaders. Leadership helps in another way. It helps in measuring the milestones. There are three basic types of opportunities to measure within your church. I call them input, output, and impact. If you measure input and input alone, what you will do is you'll look at your balance sheet and say, we did this and it produced money. And you look at your attendance and we'll say, we did this and people sat in the chairs. Okay? Now, there's nothing wrong with measuring that to some degree. But be realistic about it. You understand it takes a lot of energy to be an input-motivated ministry. You got to work hard because you got to keep touching people. Okay? And if you're big into output ministry, you will measure the number of salvations. How many of your denominations require you to send in a piece of paper and say how many people you got saved, how many people you got baptized, you know, all that kind of stuff? That's the craziest thing in the world. I'm not an output measurer. So I just look at that and go, you kidding me? I would be so rebellious. I would never send that paper in if I was denominationally attached. I say that because I'm not denominationally attached, and so I probably would. I'd have to submit. But in my humanness today, I can admit to you that that just looks like the craziest thing I've ever seen all my life. Here's why. What we're called to do, we get a lot of saved people who come here. They come here for the teaching and for the impact ministries that we do. So you could give an altar call in our church for 6 weeks straight and never get anybody saved. But you could give an altar call for impact ministry. And you'll have 50 people respond. Because that's who God sends us. So we measure impact a lot around here. We don't measure inputs. You know, the number. I mean, we do, but we don't. Again, it doesn't really make any difference how much money you have. It makes a whole lot of difference what you do with it. Right? If you've got $1 million in the bank and you're ignoring God, it's no different than having no money and ignoring God. It's just zeros. Okay? So input is one of the measurements. Output, number of salvations, baptisms, missions, witnessing, whatever else, knocking on doors, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then impact, which is the positive difference from influence. Those are the three ways that leaders will help you measure. And you should measure, at least have the opportunity to consider measuring all of those, especially if some of them are not your strength. Okay? So my strength doesn't fall in the output measuring. Number of salvations, number of baptisms, you know. Say, well, how many people have you baptized? I don't know. 1 year at the pool, we baptized 47. You know, woohoo! The next year we baptized 3. And 5 years ago or 3 years ago, we stopped doing it. So we were very successful when the people who came to our church weren't really baptized. So we've had an impact ministry, right? We had an that's what we do, impact type ministry. That's what we measure. So I can tell you in our impact ministry on Wednesday night, not last Wednesday, this coming Wednesday, there'll be 20 kids from... Where do they start? Second grade? Second grade to sixth grade? There'll be 20 second grade to sixth grade. 4 years. So 5 kids per class, or maybe more in some and less in others. Here, learning ministry and learning leadership. If you come on Sunday morning, you will see them doing that. They'll be wearing little lanyards with their picture on it that say extraordinary kids. And they'll be taking up the offering. They'll be ushering. They'll be helping parents who are new, your kid goes in this classroom. See, why? Because we have a desire for impact. It's how God's wired us. So again, when you get your leadership, they'll help you redefine. You'll find some urgencies. Do you know that leaders will figure out what needs to be fixed first? That is so important. What needs to be fixed first? Let's say that you want to start a particular ministry, whatever it is. And you just... gung-ho about it. Well, what if whatever it takes to do that needs to be fixed in your church? What if you want to have a ministry to teenagers and you've decided you're going to feed them, but your stove doesn't work? The stove might need fixed. What if you don't have money for the stove to get fixed? You see, the unintended consequence, leaders will help you find what needs to be fixed first. So around here, our leaders, when we want to start something, we go two or three layers deep. Okay, so, you know, Brian wants to start this thing, and Brian come to me, and he'll say, "Oh, Pastor, we got this great idea. We want to do this." And I will look him straight in the face, and I will say this to you: "Brian, who's going to help you do this?" "Well, never thought of that." "Oh, well, that's pretty important, because 6 weeks from now, he will have so invested every bit of his energy and been so overwhelmed by that that he'll say, 'I don't want to do this anymore.'" Maybe not 6 weeks, maybe 6 months. Sooner or later, he will be burnt out. So who's going to start the program with you? Who can you share? Now remember, if you use the anthropological rule of 150, if Brian is on my staff and I'm pastoring my 150, he comes to me with a deal, I see him as a potential pastor of 150 people. He will create. So he'll get his associate pastor, you know, his second layer of leadership. We may end up having to pay Brian to do this. So he may come on staff with us, you know, as soon as we figure out how to raise the money to do it, right? And then he will come up with his first layer, and then he'll say, "I got another layer." I said, "Okay, who else is on your radar?" Because 6 weeks to 6 months into this, I want to know he's got a third set of people that he's speaking into. Because you see, that's what leaders do. They'll help you figure out what needs to be fixed. And so now, in Brian's ministry, my church just doubled. That's a pretty good plan, isn't it? Now you say, "Well, it doesn't work that way in my church." Here's why it doesn't work that way in most people's churches, is because they haven't assessed the leadership. Now maybe Brian, and forgive me, I think he's a qualified leader, but let's say that he's not all that qualified. He's not a 150 member guy. Okay, then I need three of him in his ministry to be able to do that. Because most people aren't. You, as pastors, are probably at the top. You can probably pastor, most of you effectively can pastor between 50 and 150 people. You really can. So if you're going to get any bigger than that, you better figure out who's going to do it. So in our church, our administrator, Randy, who handles all benevolent ministries, he's pastoring his volunteer team. And he's got a pile of them. He's pastoring what happens in those ministries. Jeremy, who normally sits back there, I don't know how many volunteers Jeremy has, dozens. Their leadership skills may not be as high as mine, but when you assess your leaders, you can watch for them. And then when it gets too big, you split it off. See? You say, okay, so we have three people, right? Who I'm still on the extraordinary kids. Two teachers. A staff person in charge, and a supervisory staff person in charge. So we're four levels deep in that ministry. And we're looking for people. My youth people just came to us last week and said, "Hey, we're really thinking that these people are going to help us." I said, "Praise God. Take a run at them. See what happens." I will guarantee you when they get their next group of leaders in there, because we've assessed their leadership skills, that they will, by their skill set, bring people in. You say, "Well, we don't have people." Listen, you don't have to bring them in like we do or like the church down the street does. Again, assess it correctly. That brings up the next point. In Numbers chapter 13, beginning of verse 17, he says, "Then Moses sent them out to spy out the land of Canaan to see, go up this way to the south and see what the land is like," verse 18, "whether the people who dwell in it are strong, weak, few, or many, and whether the land they dwell in is good or bad, whether the cities they inhabit are like camps or strongholds, whether the land is rich or poor." Now here's the point. After you assess the leaders, you have to assess the territory. There are three equations in your territory, in all of our territories. There's the people equation. Who is there? If you want to have a ministry to immigrants and you don't have any immigrants in your town, good luck with that. See who's there. If you've got like one of our communities, you know, each one of our communities has some fairly high levels of Hispanic people, labor folks and that kind of stuff. Well, okay, you know that we don't have a Hispanic ministry here. You want to know why? They come from a culture that won't drive that far. If you go to some of the Latin cultures, there's a church about every three blocks because that's all the farther they'll go. Church of about 35 people every three blocks. If you live in their three-block radius, you go to church there. Because they won't go any further than that. Guess what we learned? That's just true for the parents. Their kids are in high school and they'll come to our youth group. So we don't have adult Hispanic ministries, but we got people on our youth team that can speak Spanish. Yeehaw! Why? Because the kids are coming. They love it. Parents want their own thing. So what do? You assess the people. Who's there? And that's what I call that is localizing your vision. Localizing your vision. I remember there were several things that God was saying to me when I was in Imperial that I learned over the course of time were never going to happen there. This ministry started in my heart in that church. Why? You know, what do we do? What do we do here? It took me 15 years to figure out how to get this going. I've always had a heart for pastors. Localize your vision. There's a culture equation. You got a people equation and you got a culture equation. Why are they here? Why are they here? Do you know why people move to your area? Did they come for your church? Probably not. Why do they come? They came for a job. They left because there wasn't a job. They came because their family lives here. If you'll understand the culture of that, you'll quit wasting your time on people that aren't called to your group because you'll understand the culture. Or you'll look for somebody who can speak into their life who's not like you. Understand the culture equation. Why are they here? And the last thing, you know, see what the land is like, see what the fruit equation. There's always a fruit equation. So here's how I put that. If you drive by the local bar at 11 o'clock at night and you can't find a parking spot because you went to check it out, you know, you weren't actually going to go there, right? You just went to see who was there because you understand that there's a fruit equation here. So if you went by this place and you realize that, man, there's a lot of people there, that is an area where it's a possibility for some fruit. So then you go back to the leadership quotient and you say, okay, now what do I have? What do we presently have? What kind of things can we do? I don't know if I told you guys this story or not, but there's a church in the Front Range that was looking for a secondary building, what do they call it? A satellite area. They're gonna broadcast their service across town. They went looking and they found a building that was for sale over there, but it was occupied. Guess what was in it? A strip club. Guess what they did? They bought it. Why? The fruit equation. You say, they bought a strip club? Yeah, well, it needed some cleaning, you know. And they put their church in it. They closed the strip club down. When their lease was up, they no longer renewed it, and they built a church over there. But they had the opportunity during that time as the owners of the building to deal with the owners of the business and to not burn the bridge just because they had a strip club. I wouldn't have been a good candidate for that. But you see, that's what God was... They looked at this fruit equation and go, praise God, what's this going to be like? How many people are going to drive up to this building at 4 o'clock in the afternoon when the strip club opens because there's cars there, but they're church staff cars? How many people might come in the door expecting there to be something other than some religious guy sitting at a desk? They really thought that through. I thought that was great. So see the fruit equation. In 2 Corinthians, I think chapter 10, about somewhere down through there, 12th through 14th verse, Paul is talking. He says, I don't want to have influence except where I've had influence called. You know, my influence extends as far as you, I think it says, or something like that. I believe every church and every individual has a sphere of influence. So inside that sphere of influence, when you're looking at the territory, look at the people equation. Who's there? Look at the culture equation. Why are they there? And then look at the fruit equation. What's there? What do you need to minister to? And for heaven's sakes, if you're in a small town, stop fighting against the school. They're going to have basketball games and track things and all that kind of stuff. Buy your staff or buy whoever else season tickets to the thing and have them wear your t-shirt to the event. And then treat it as an opportunity, man. Go in there with your New Life Christian Center shirt on and go sit by everybody you can see that you think you might know. Look at the people. You say, well, that's a lot of work, Pastor. Well, okay, if what you're doing is working perfectly well, then don't try anything else. But if it's not, then at least give this uncharted territory stuff, because you're knocking it down for how you're wired already. You're doing the best you can do for how you're wired. So if this is it, then let's make some changes. Okay? You know that when you get to the territory assessment, the leaders are going to have to make some tough decisions. Are you aware of that? Tough decisions. Because guess what you get to do? You get to decide where your limited funds are going to be spent. See, up to this point, what are we doing? We're doing what we're doing. And now we look at this territory and we say, wow, there's some stuff here that we might have to do. Where does that money come from? See, the redirection of funds is one of the most important things in uncharted territories. What do you do? Where do you get the money? Where does it go? How does that work? You have to have that conversation. Here's even a harder conversation to have. What if we're supposed to stop a ministry? The average church of 138 folks has between 30 and 40 ministry things. Do the math. It's like 4 people per ministry event. I will tell you that most of those ministries are totally ineffective. But the 4 people who love them, they just keep coming, smiling, going, whew. You know, if you got a ministry like that, got 4 people in it, man, sacrifice the sacred cow, put the hamburger in the freezer, and move on. It's hard. I tell you it's hard. You know, we closed a ministry here that was beloved in our county. I still have parents in my church who are lamenting the day. We closed, one of my staff members' daughter was going to enter school the year we closed. His oldest daughter was going to enter into school the year we closed. They still talk about it. They're still sorry about it. Oh, I wish we had the academy. And we graduated some great kids out of there. That day is over. We have the hamburger in the freezer to prove it. It's done. Let me tell you about the uncharted territory benefits. We closed the school. I learned that the church was subsidizing the school to the tune of $50,000 a year. Guess what? The day you close it, you ought to be thinking what you're going to do with your $50,000. Because it's now available. Think you can make some changes with that? Oh, man. Our church budget was... And I don't want to... Our church budget has tripled since the closing of the academy. Tripled. You say, why did that happen? There's too many functional things that I would have to take in. It's too specific to us. It's not going to happen to you unless you've got a $50,000 ministry you're planning on closing. But here's the point in all of that. The decision-making process included, what do we close? What do we do with the redirection of funds? How do we take our focus? Now, if you have an inwardly focused church, where your biggest vote is whether or not we put 4-inch pads or 2-inch pads on the pews for our comfort, you're inwardly focused, okay? And so you have to change that if you're going to grow into this territory that God... You all understand when I'm talking about territory here. God's called you to have an impact in your area. It's not competition. Your church is different than the one down the street. It just is. You're doing things differently. There's a different personality. There's a different focus. There's a different shape to it. It's okay. Just do that really well. Third thing. Look at Numbers chapter 13. Look at the 26th verse. Now they departed and came back to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation. They brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. So they went out and looked at the territory. They chose leaders. They looked at the territory. And then they came back to report the results. Now, here's where it gets really dicey for you as a leader. they reported the results, which were exactly what was kind of prophesied to them. This is a land flowing with milk and honey. In fact, the one verse says it's truly flowing with milk and honey. But then they added their opinion. So, if as a leader you're going to take this step, you're going to have to be willing to sort the opinions, or you're going to have to see the vision line up with the results and throw everything else away. So if they come to you and they say, it truly flows with milk and honey, and then the next word out of their mouth is but, you're going to have to discount everything, you know. Like, I'm kind of a blunt preacher, and I say Christians would be a lot better if they get their butt out of the way. And I mean, they do. It's just like God said, but we can't do it. Just like God said, but it'll never happen here. But we don't have enough money. That's, you notice that they never ask them those questions. They said, go look at the people. Didn't ask if they had enough money to do it. Didn't ask if they thought ahead of time. They just said, go spy out the land. And they did. And they came back, 10 of them, with a bad report. And about verse, I don't know where it is, 30 maybe in there. So, 27, he says, they told him, we win the land where you sent us. It truly flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. And of course, they've got grapes between a stave that they're carrying, you know, this awesome stuff. And then we have the word, nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell there. Verse 30. Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it. He's only speaking the vision. Caleb could have stayed home and said this, but there's only two guys against 10. Moses, as a leader, figured out what needed to happen. He said, wait a minute here, I'm supposed to lead everybody in here. So I believe, and this is where my idea comes in, is whenever you're leading into uncharted territory, there are several things you should expect. Now, I know some of you who are like ultra-faith people, oh, we don't expect bad things. Okay, whatever. I think you should expect opposition. You should expect opposition. Now, why do I say expect opposition? If you're surprised by it, do you respond differently? Because I think we do. And so if you say to yourself, you know what, we're going to go this way, and this is what God's saying, and I know there are going to be some people. Now stop short of doing what Tracy said and knowing people according to the flesh. Well, so-and-so isn't going to like this. We're not asking that question. Prayerfully contemplate what the opposition looks like, not who it is. Expect the bad report. Some people's call in life is to rain on your parade. Expect the bad report. Yeah, this will never work. I remember I got in trouble in this church for doing the math of our area. In Yuma County, there are about 10,000 people who live in Yuma County. There are about 25 churches. Now, I'm a simple man, but I can do the math. 25 into 10,000 is 400. The average impact of every church in Yuma County should be 400 people to totally evangelize our county. Which, by the way, do you understand that God's interest is not in your church, but in the world? Right? Come on, God so loved the world. So, you know, we get inside the church and say, God so loves us, look what he's doing. No, he loved the world. His whole focus, his ultimate concern is the world. And so I think everybody should have an opportunity to get saved. Which to me means that every church should have at least 400 chairs. You're lazy if you don't, and I said this from the pulpit. I thought it was a good sermon. I thought it would stir people up. It did stir them up to kill me. You know, and I said, man, we got to figure out what we got to do. We got to get some chairs. And so then I came to reality. And so let me tell you what this church does. There are 300 of these chairs. Okay? That's what fits in the room. So our part is 300. Okay? And we have enough tables and chairs in the rest of the building to set 300 people down and feed them. Just in case the world comes to an end or we need to build a commune. No, not really. What did we do? We took a look with our leaders and said, okay, what does this look like? And we worked towards that end. So if the anointing falls somehow and people need to come to a church, we're prepared to handle the share that God called us to, plus what other people are unprepared to handle. We've staffed differently. Now, please don't go away and say, oh, we can't do that. The reason I teach this is because it's what we've done. We assessed our leadership. Tracy and I start ministries, and right now, other than this ministry, I'm not doing anything extra in our church. I'm not on the jail team. I don't go here. I don't go there. I don't do any of those things. We're waiting for God to tell us what's next. We'll start something and raise up somebody to run it, because we can only pastor. Actually, I tell people often, Tracy and I are really average pastors. I can only pastor about 20 people. Honestly, I get really irritated with the others. I get my 20. I'm happy with that. Praise God. You know, but I'm irritated with the rest. So I try to raise up people that can pastor those folks. I say, go work with Jeremy. You know, he's like you. Messy. So anyway, expect opposition. Expect the bad report. That's the second thing. Third thing, expect improper perspective. People are not going to see things right. In this case, they said in the report, this land devours its inhabitants. Think about that for a second. If it actually did, why are there any people there? If it actually devours its inhabitants, why are there any people there? Why weren't they all gone? The land is devouring them. See, this is his perspective. And then he said, they're great big, and we are, a 33rd verse somewhere, we are what? Grasshoppers in our own sight. That's a perspective issue. You can change that in your church. Did you know that if you preach long enough that your church can change the world, that your church will actually believe they can change the world? It's not easy in the beginning. Because when you tell people that our responsibility is for the 400 people in Yuma County, they will look around and say, "That we don't know a church that big in this area, and this isn't going to be it either." I happen to say to that particular person who thought I was exceedingly arrogant to say that, I happen to say to them, hide and watch, which probably wasn't the right thing to say. But nonetheless, it's just true as true can be. So see the vision as results. Expect opposition. Expect the bad report. And expect perspective diffusing or perspective, improper perspective. People aren't going to see things quite right. And you may have to take them back over and over and over again to do that. All right. So in the afternoon session today, we're going to talk about navigation principles. So we're going to try and show you a couple of things that'll help you in processing your own uncharted territory. And we're going to start with something called the power of unlearning. Albert Einstein says, the greatest difficulty I have in becoming educated is my education. It was in the way. Some of you have gone through the school and they taught you whatever they taught you, and you're having to fight. You have to unlearn some of those things. Right? When Peter and John went to the temple gate thingy, and the lame guy was there, and they got in all kinds of trouble, and they took him in, I don't know, chapter 4, and they took him in, and they interrogated them. They said, don't you do this. And then the one guy said, but we perceive that you are both uneducated and untrained, but you've evidently been with Jesus. That's a great, great scripture, 13th verse of Acts chapter 4. That's a great, great scripture, because it tells us that God from the very beginning was using people who were willing to be seen as uneducated. Willing to be seen as uneducated. Do you know that your theological bent and your ability to translate the Bible from Greek into English and all that kind of stuff is not really all that impressive to the people in your church? Your knowledge of Hebrew words and your ability to enunciate those with all the hacking and coughing and spitting that it takes to speak Hebrew, they're not at all impressed by that. But your love of them impresses people. You can be uneducated and untrained, and you can follow because you've been with Jesus. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. We'll talk about the three things that are God's ultimate goals here in the second half of our time. So anyway, so now you know what uncharted territory is, and so we'll talk in the afternoon about how to kind of navigate those and get to that place. So we'll talk about let me help you. So maybe you can by thinking along those lines. We'll talk about the power of unlearning, the power of communication standards, and the power of leadership. So we'll talk about those three things in uncharted areas in the afternoon deal. All right, I bet they're ready to feed us. Did I leave you with more questions than answers? You all okay? I know this was maybe more teachy than what it really comes out of our experience. Right, our church is in an uncharted territory right now. You have a question? Campbell. Our church is in uncharted territory right now. We're not exactly sure what's next, but man, are we excited by it. 14. Well, probably, you mean just kind of, just the way it is. Yeah, the state of, yeah, you're probably right.
The church is in flux, it's changing, everything's changing.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah. Some of you probably more than others. Yes, sir? Talk loud. Inherited leaders?
Inherited.
Oh, yeah.
I've been in my church for 10 years now, and I read off all the two of my inherited leaders. I don't know where all of you guys are in your journey with your particular church, but if I would have done a better job of assessing that leadership, I wouldn't have dug myself such a great hole.
At any point, I mean, you're right at the beginning. You can always save yourself some steps the earlier you do it.
Yeah, it just kicked my tail because I lost so many people. And they may have been on the way out. I don't really know. And I may have wanted them to be just because I didn't assess them properly.
Yeah. We assessed leadership reasonably well from the beginning. We didn't assess our territory very well. We didn't realize what that was going to look like. So.